So that's an example of, you know, magical power condensed onto the material plane.
Oh,
yeah.
We saw
a film about 2 nights ago of dolphins swimming, and it was purple triangles coming from their head. It was captured on film.
Clearly, the same phenomenon.
First of all, I have to ask an inevitable question. Did the man do his counter singing after that?
He actually didn't come back after that evening.
Then the other question, or actually a perspective, is I have done extensive work with iridology to the point that I could understand where the limitations in that science were blatantly obvious, because it's not so much the physical characteristics of the iris of the eye, it is what is transmitted from the mind through the pupil or the sensor of that filter that is really being accessed by someone who is discerning. And that's what will give you the blueprint that you're looking for. And so I feel that that power and that transmission of mind so many times is carried from that energy that goes back and forth through the eyes. And I wondered if you had any more thoughts on that.
Well, it seems to imply that we are all potentially linked together in many ways that civilization has suppressed. We are no longer telepathic. We are no longer able to reach out and tap somebody with a glance like that. And
but I think we do, and I think we do all the time.
But somehow our perception of what's been going on is skewed. We don't, you know, Rupert and I talked a lot about this. He had the idea that, he said, you know, the search for proof of psychic power has not been a very happy story with card flipping and this sort of thing. And Rupert had the genius to realize that what is the commonest psychic power that we all believe exists and have experienced and so forth, but which science is utterly unable to explain, that could be statistically studied? Well, what it is the sense that someone is looking at you, you know? And you could test this, and in fact, we did tests where you would choose one person and put them at the front of a room full of people, and then you would tell people, either look at your lap or look at the back of this person's head, and they would be asked, are people looking at you? Or are people looking at the back of looking at their lap? And certain people, you could quickly satisfy yourself, were able to detect this a phenomenal amount of the time, well beyond statistical, the rules of probability. So I think we're surrounded by subliminal abilities that we can't really understand. I mean, from years of traveling in Asia, I have an amazing psychic power, which is I can tell when food shouldn't be eaten, you know, and it will happen to me, you know, in very good restaurants, and if I go against it, you know, I'll spend the evening over the toilet because I couldn't believe that Shay so-and-so would serve poisoned food because it was costing me so much money. But then when I get back to the hotel room, sure enough, by overriding my own instincts, I get into trouble. I think psychic ability, well, this is worth talking about, that we cannot be, or how can I put it, we cannot evolve beyond the confines of our language. And if you have a language that makes telepathy impossible, then telepathy will be impossible inside that culture. You see, we all pay lip service to the idea that that language and culture create each other, but we actually act as though culture is real, and it isn't. I learned this, you know, in Peru very dramatically, because in the Peruvian Amazon there's a disease which people are very, very concerned about called susto. Have all of you heard of this? Susto only affects Peruvians. This is the first clue that something weird is going on. And its major manifestation is bad luck. But if you get it, and you're a Peruvian, you prepare to cash in your chips. You know, it's as horrible as melanoma. You know, you're doomed if you have this stuff. And you have to go to a shaman and get it taken care of, or you're dead within 6 months. But I can't get susto. It's a linguistic disease of some sort. It travels around inside the confines of mestizo Spanish and nowhere else.
But it's the evil eye, isn't it, also? Is the equation in the deep south of our country?
Yeah, people have these ideas, yeah. And, you know, like people say, well, magic is accomplished because the person the magic is being done to knows that it's happening, and therefore they unconsciously participate in their own demise. But I've observed these shamans in the Amazon, and they will go, if a shaman has decided to actually get somebody, then he will go to incredible lengths to conceal what he's doing, so that the person never knows and never knows how to blame. So it isn't some kind of psychological co-option that's happening. It's something a good deal more complex than that. Yeah.
A while back you were talking about a period of time where much magic kind of died out. And that made me think about some of the things we've been saying. For example, we have all these myths about fairies and elves and magic. And perhaps at one time the world was like that, but it is not like that now. Here you're talking about a social context that does not include telepathy, generates a culture without people experiencing telepathy. And yet we have all these myths. We have all the fairy tales. You know? And now that you're talking about self-transforming machine elves, would you have a thought on this?
Well, I'm not sure that you got it into a question that I can respond to. Try again.
Okay, so our culture then is very like science-oriented. And the whole idea of magic, things like the existence of elves, Findhorn, people laugh at that unless they're on the supposed fringes. Do you think that this kind of thing could come back? Do you think that we will have, like for our eyes, for example, experiences with these kind of things?
Yes, sure, because what you have to do is you have to shift the locus. I mean, it's kind of hard to explain, but every civilization has a locus. And we have disempowered ourselves by shifting the locus to an imagined class of experts. We have an incredibly peculiar version of how the universe is put together. First of all, we rely a lot of the time on the notion of the insi-binsi, genes, viruses, atoms, elementary particles. These are the things which shape our world. We tell each other, and yet who has ever seen any of these things? I mean, a virus, maybe a few people have seen. A hydrogen atom, it's a pretty airy, fairy concept. And when you start talking about the anti-mu meson and stuff like that, where you can only approach it through an arcane mathematical language, the reality, whatever that means, of these things becomes pretty questionable. See, one of the things I think that psychedelics could do is give back to us what I call the immediacy of felt experience. Since the rise of Cartesian analysis in the 17th century, everything that we experience has been defined as what are called secondary characteristics. Color, a secondary characteristic. Feeling, and what's real is mass, momentum, charge, spin, stuff like this, which, you know, these are the primary qualities of the universe. Whoever encounters or deals with them, we need to model reality so that it is understandable to us. I mean, that that statement should even have to be made shows how far off track we are. Our current model of reality is excellent for describing the behavior of hydrogen at the center of stars or something like that. Terrible for explaining to you how you're supposed to stay tuned to your girlfriend. So somehow we have sold out to abstraction. And this is something about science, you know, and the demonic power of numerical analysis and stuff like this. I think that part of what the psychedelic revolution is and why it is so politically threatening is because a psychedelic person does not believe anything they cannot confirm for themselves through thought, intuition, or feeling. And a non-psychedelic person joins up with the quantum physicists or the Hasidic Jews or some group of people who've already got it packaged and figured out. I mean, the UFO thing is a good example. Everybody's interested in UFOs and, you know, are there space people, are there not? And I think most people think that the news will come, that the way you encounter a UFO, the way most of us will encounter a UFO, is that the president will call a press conference and say, you know, that the time has come to speak frankly about certain declassified material and that, yes, in fact, it has been going on. I mean, that's not how it's going to happen. The way it's going to happen is on 5 grams in silent darkness in your living room, and that's real. You know, if flying saucers were to land on the south lawn of the White House tomorrow, it would be minor news compared to what can happen to you a minute and a half after smoking DMT. We don't realize that we are not real unless we are the center of our own private mandala. And so we look to media, to experts. You know, maybe the Dalai Lama can clarify it, or Mother Teresa, or Stephen Hawking. Well, forget all that. Those are just linguistic concepts as far as you're concerned. The only thing that's real to you is yourself and your immediate surroundings. And if we could empower that, you know, our political problems would disappear overnight. We are infantile and we do love it. We don't really try to claim our existential validity. And those who do are called mad, because they depart from the sanctioned paradigm. Over here, somebody. Yeah.
It just struck me that one of the things that you seem real good at is bringing that personal experience into language and being able to communicate it, which creates the same kind of reality that you appear to be decrying of a shared linguistic reality where we can discuss the experience that we've had. Its value becomes elevated when we talk about it.
Yes, well, it becomes real when we talk about it. I mean, one of the most satisfying experiences that I have as a public speaker is sometimes after speaking to groups like last night, somebody will come up afterward and say, "I thought I was crazy until I heard you speak. Now I know there are at least two of us." And the truth is, you know, there are more than two of us. There are thousands. If you, you know, it's a delusion if it happens to one person. It's a cult if it happens to 20 people. And it's true if it happens to 10,000 people. Well, this is a strange way to have epistemological authenticity conferred upon something. We vote on it, you know. So I would like competition. I mean, I feel pretty lonely out here. I'm surprised nobody has followed me into this. There must be other people who can articulate these things as well or better than I can. But boy, they don't seem to come forth. And I really don't know why that is, because what I say is not all that exceptional. It's just the sum total of it is kind of eerie. But if we don't, that's why I was saying, you know, we cannot evolve faster than we evolve our language. Our language is like the collective skin of our culture. So, you know, until you say the words self-transforming elf machines from hyperspace, then there aren't such things. Once you say it, it has gained a certain kind of ontological currency.
So weren't you arguing the opposite point, you know, when you spoke about becoming a quantum physicist or a Jew?
Well,
a language system.
See, people are buying other people's experience. I mean, if you're not a quantum physicist, why in the world should you take those people seriously? They're talking gibberish. What power does it have over you, except that it comes presented on the platter of science? Say, you must believe this. If you don't believe this, you're not a well-educated, trendy, with it person. We can just say, well, malarkey. Didn't you people believe something completely different 15 years ago? You say, yes, but now we've got it. Say, well, am I supposed to take that assertion seriously? You change your mind every 6 months.
But our experience during the psychedelic experience,
uh-huh,
before we bring it to language, is you know, ungraspable, very frustrating once we lose it. And you know, we can't settle down until we bring it to language. That's what they've done with their experience. They brought it to language, then they can kind of settle down and play with it. So we seem to be caught in the thing of if we're having a true experience of dealing with it, it's you know, beyond concept. If once we conceptualize it, it becomes not quite an experience, but the experience really changes. And it becomes something that we can then tokenize and pass to each other and have a good social time with. But, you know, we're missing it.
Well, every entity has a value dark dimension. I mean, surely only the most naive of quantum physicists believe that the quantum electrodynamic description of the electron is all there is to say about the electron, because biology is made out of electrons, and you can't reason from quantum electrodynamics to the rainforest. You know, obviously other factors are present which are escaping this particular linguistic model. So being able to talk about something doesn't rob it of its mystery. It merely is a sectioning through it that gives you a kind of a lower dimensional map of it. But the mystery remains intact. You know, Wittgenstein talks about what he called the unspeakable. And, you know, the unspeakable is the true domain of being. And then within that, there is a very small subset of those things which can actually be captured in language. But they're a vanishingly small set of the whole thing. Mostly it's all mystery. I don't know why this is so surprising to people. I mean, where is it writ large that bipedal primates with binocular vision are supposed to be carrying around in their heads true models of the cosmos? I mean, would you expect an apple tree or a monarch butterfly to have a true map of the cosmos inside them? No more than that we should have. So I think all knowledge is provisional. And I think the new science will honor this. This is why the rise in the use of the word model. They no longer believe they're giving a complete explanation of phenomenon. They just say, well, here's a model, and next year we'll get a better model, and we'll keep modeling, and our models will get better and better. But they will never be more than crude approximations to an unspeakable mystery.
Do you find that tragic?
No, I find it exhilarating. I think part of the male or part of the ego dominator pathology is to demand closure out of everything. There is no closure. You have to learn to sit with the messiness of the mystery. You know, it's this thing we said this morning. The bigger you build the bonfire of understanding, the more darkness is revealed to your startled eye. So, no, I think it's open-ended and exhilarating and tremendously exciting that that's the kind of universe we're living in.
Charles, I think this thing about mysteries, I find it fascinating. I think up until just a few months ago, my main thing was trying to understand. And I read something somewhere, some little sentence that said, I'm not trying to understand the mystery anymore, I'm just trying to have a relationship with it.
That's right.
Well,
you know, this is not merely the stoned ravings of the psilocybin brigade. Do you all know or have you ever heard of Gödel's incommensurability theorem? This sounds daunting and disturbing. Have you ever heard of this? Does anybody have a clue what I'm talking about? Okay, well, that in itself is a measure of the kind of society we're living in, because to my mind, more important than Einstein or Schrödinger or any of those people was Kurt Gödel, German mathematician. And he began by studying the calculus, and he had a very funny method. What he did was he would number every operation in a partial differential equation. And these numbers are called Gödel numbers. G-O-U-M-L-O-T-D-E-L, Kurt Gödel. And what he showed, and I think this is maybe the most important intellectual step taken in the 20th century, he showed that any formal system will produce true statements which are not provable within the confines of the formal system itself. Now, what this actually means is that mathematics can fail. It means that there is no closure. He proved this logically, showed that closure is impossible, that everything, he showed it for arithmetic, the most secure of all intellectual edifices. Essentially, what he showed was that 2 plus 2 equals 4 is a very strong tendency, not a law. And this incommensurability theorem means that no program of formal analysis will ever completely exhaust its subject. There will always be a residuum of mystery. And we need to come to terms with this. I mean, it's taken us 80 years to get Einstein under our belts. And that's a simple notion compared to what Gödel is saying, because what he's saying is not about, you know, the distortion of space-time near massive objects, but something which actually affects our own lives on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, if you live for closure, you're beating your head against a stone wall, and your head will wear out long before the stone wall will. There's a kind of an appreciation for the mystery needs to replace the attitude that the mystery is an unsolved problem. Mysteries have no relationship whatsoever to unsolved problems. Yeah?
I'm just wondering about the motivation of the explorer going into the dark continent, wanting to draw a map of the river, you know, so that he can eventually build a railroad, et cetera, et cetera. That you go through a lot of pain, a lot of difficulty as a pioneer to get the map back. If your primary assumption is that this map will never be drawn completely, where's the motivation? What does it then become?
You don't need a complete map. I mean, I'm not such a fan of Wittgenstein, but he seems to have raised his ugly head here. Wittgenstein used to say, we do not seek statements which are true. We seek statements which are true enough. That's this genuflection to the incommensurability theorem. That's as good as it gets, folks. True enough. beyond that, there's just, you know, the airy realm of metaphysics, which will never be plumbed. So what we're trying to do is refine our model, make it more responsive to what we want the model to tell us. But you don't want to confuse the model with the phenomenon being modeled, because it will always have dimensions which exceed the grasp of the theory.
Well, that's what the probability is on says that there's a tendency for a particular state to exist. That's as good as it gets.
Yes, although I have real problems with probability theory, which we'll probably get into tomorrow. I think that in a sense, probability theory has made it almost impossible for us to think clearly about anything, because it contains certain insidious built-in assumptions that are purely assumptions. For instance, probability theory tells you that when you flip a coin, the odds of it being heads or tails are 50-50. If, in fact, that were true, the coin would land on its edge every single time. So what we need, you see, is not a theory of what is possible. That's science. If you want to know if something is possible, you find a scientist, and they're always perfectly happy to fulfill this function and tell you whether this is possible or not. What we completely lack as a civilization is a theory that explains to us how it is, out of the vast class of possible things, certain things undergo what Alfred North Whitehead called the formality of actually occurring. We have no theory. I mean, science can say, well, it's probable that it'll be this, but it's also 40% probable that it'll be that. You say, well, which will it be? You say, well, I just told you the probabilities. You say, that's not good enough. I want to know. You say, we have no theory of selecting among the probabilities. The other problem that haunts probability theory is that it assumes that time is an absolute flat plane. It assumes that no physicist tells you in his lab notes, please perform my experiment on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays, because it won't work any other time. In other words, the assumption is made that the experiment will produce the data predicted by theory no matter when the experiment is performed. In other words, it's assumed that the phenomena is time independent. But that's just an assumption that Newton got into. Proving that phenomena are time independent is absolutely beyond our intellectual reach. It can't be done. A curious thing about probability theory is, say you want to know how much current is flowing through a wire. Here's how probability theory finds out. It measures the current flowing through the wire with a meter. It measures it 1,000 times. It takes those values and adds them together. Then it divides by 1,000. Then it tells you this is how much current is flowing through the wire. You look at the value they've given you and you say, but we took 1,000 measurements and we never got this number. Say, well, that's because, you know, you didn't average the probability. And, well, if we took 1,000 measurements and not one is the value you're offering, why should we believe that this is the amount of current flowing through the wire? Well, then there's a bunch of hand-waving and epistemic foot-stamping and so forth. Science is an incredibly fragile edifice, which if it weren't for its ability to hand its findings on to technologists who make pretty things, it would have to take its place somewhere to the left of, I don't know, homeopathy, acupressure, something like that. In other words, it is not a meta-theory. It has not got truth by the jugular. It has a bunch of fishy mathematical formula, which it's flailing you with. But I don't think, I think that serious revision of probability theory is going to have to take place
think you've given probability theory much more than it's really there. Inherently, what it's all about is simply acknowledging the fact that there are variables in anything that we can't know, and we don't know. It's really nothing more than that.
Which brings you back to just the access to the present moment.
Well, but for instance, if the odds that the coin comes up heads or tails are 50-50, why doesn't it land on its edge every single time?
I don't see how it's related to landing on its edge. It's simply what happens with a coin where it ends up lying, basically, whether it's face up or down, right?
Well, you know, another thing probability theory says is that chance has no memory. And so first-year statistics, they say, if you flip a coin and it comes up heads 49 times, what are the odds it will come up heads the 50th time? The answer is 50-50. But any gambler would tell you that, you know, if it comes up heads 5 times in a row, bet on heads, for crying out loud. So there's something...
I'm not an acolyte of probability or statistics, because I think a lot is done or inferred from them. It just doesn't exist. I agree. At the same time, really all it's at the basis is the notion that there are things going on here that we can't know, even though that's not acknowledged by most people who are practicing it. That's the reality, probability of statistics.
But don't you think the other assumption is that time is a non-inputting, it's not variable, you know, that you don't say the odds of the coin coming up heads or tails are 50-50 in Canada, but 48-52 in Bolivia.
That's one of the variables that's sort of smeared out simply because it can't be characterized the way people who are doing that like to tend to characterize them. But underlying the whole thing is still the notion that you're dealing with unknowables. And I'm not saying that those who are deeply immersed in practicing probability of statistics hold this view, but the reality is underlying this sort of underpinning the whole thing is the notion that there are things going on here that we can't know.
Oh, well, I don't have any trouble with that. I understand why science latched on to probability with such a vengeance. It's because, you know, thanks to William of Ockham, there is this notion called Ockham's razor, which is this idea that is most simply stated as hypotheses should not be multiplied without necessity. So since the idea that time is a flat invariant is the simplest assumption, try it first and see if it works. But I maintain that, you know, science has in certain areas been very slow to make progress in the social domain, in econometrics, in the, you know, multiple body problems and stuff like that. Well, I think this is because this simple assumption that time is an invariant has to be re-examined. I would almost offer a new definition of science. Science is that field of human endeavor which studies phenomenon so crude that they are time invariant. You know, the hydrogen atom cleaves from the oxygen atom the same way every time. But love affairs don't come apart the same way every time. Bankruptcies don't occur the same way every time. These are complex compound phenomena that are then influenced by the temporal variables and the variables embedded in the environment around them. Now, the problem is, these are the things we're interested in. Love affairs, bankruptcies, and the establishment of empires. Very few people have a passionate interest in the dynamics of the water molecule.
Except that that equipment over there was produced by those notions, these notebook computers, the software that you're running.
Oh, now I know I have you on the run because this is a but it makes pretty things argument.
No, I'm not commenting on the value of it or not. I mean, each person has to assess that for himself.
Well, see, I think science is a great enterprise and noble, but not the arbiter of truth. There are no arbiters of truth. The truth of the Tarot, the truth of quantum physics, these are truths in the supermarket of truth. But there's no top end to that process. There may not even be one truth. In a given situation. If you're flipping coins, probability theory is probably a good guide. You wouldn't want to run your love affair on probability theory. So you have to choose the domain. You have to recognize the applicable models, the applicable tools for whatever domain you're looking at. Well, you're allowed to be a heretic. You just don't get paid well. That's the price you pay for that. Still, yeah.
Kind of tying this into what you were talking about last night about how messed up everything is since our ancestors got away from the mushroom celebrations and all that. It seemed like you were saying that we are tied into time and we're being pulled towards a certain something, like this dimension being destroyed, or we're not really being able to live. And I'm wondering, is that, it seemed like you looked at that as bad. And then on a different perspective, it's good because we're discovering that we're being pulled towards something that's maybe bigger and more wonderful. How does that tie in? Are you saying that this is bad what we're discovering, so we need to hang on to our past? Or are you saying
no, no. No, I don't think it's bad. I'm entirely in support of whatever the universe is in the process of trying to do here. I think that history is ending, and that it was a temporary perturbation of the system, and that we can anchor ourselves through this chaostrophe or whatever it is by going back to archaic models. But I think that, and you know, this is what we'll talk about tomorrow when we get the computer, because I don't merely talk about it, even though I've been flailing the mathematicians. Ultimately, I too come to rest with a fishy formula. I think that the universe is some kind, I think that there's something that has been overlooked by science called, and I'll name it, it's called novelty. The universe is a novelty-conserving engine of some sort. From the very first nanoseconds after the Big Bang, novelty has been conserving itself and building newer and deeper levels of novelty on novelty already achieved, so that you know, in the first few, I mean, you have the Big Bang, then you have this era called the pre-physical era. It's brief. It lasts the amount of time it takes light to cross a distance equivalent to the diameter of the proton, electron, something dinky for sure. That's called the era before physics. Then physics begins one jiffy after that. And the original universe was so hot that it was a plasma of free electrons. So since it was a plasma, there was nothing that you could call atomic physics, because the ambient temperature was so high that electrons could not settle down into stable orbitals around nuclei. As the temperature of the universe fell, atomic systems crystallized out of that plasmic environment. Well, then, further cooling of the universe leads to more complex kinds of bonds and the cooking out of complex elements from stars. The original universe was made entirely of hydrogen. This hydrogen aggregated into masses so dense, so large, that at their centers there was actually, and if you think I'm not nervous doing this in front of you, you're crazy. these aggregates of hydrogen at the center, it was so massive in temperature and pressure that fusion could actually begin, and fusion cooked out heavier elements, iron, sulfur, and eventually carbon. Well, when you get four-valent carbon, this throws open the doorway to tremendous new novelty. You get now, for the first time, not atomic systems, but molecular systems. And these molecular systems lead into protobiological systems. Protobiological systems lead into prokaryotes, then eukaryotes, then true higher multicellular animals, then mammals, then human beings, then electronic culture, then the big surprise. Now, the thing to notice about all this is that novelty keeps building on novelty already achieved. It crosses biological lines, atomic lines, molecular lines. It is a law of the universe, I'm proposing, that novelty is conserved. And so then what we represent is the kind of ultimate nexus of novelty. And I believe that, you know, we are being wound tighter and tighter and tighter into a confrontation with the equivalent of the singularity at the center of a black hole. But it isn't a gravitational singularity that I'm talking about. It's a novelty singularity. And so, you know, the universe is growing toward some kind of ultimate state of boundaryless hyperconnectivity. And when that is achieved, the process will cease to be describable in the locus of ordinary space, time, and energy. Now, science has no notion of this concept of novelty. In the East, there is such a concept. It's called Tao. And Tao builds things up and pulls them down according to its own mysterious laws. Tomorrow I will argue, when we get the computer, that its laws are not in fact entirely mysterious, and that we can discover the nature of the novelty constant. And instead of treating space-time as an absolutely featureless plane, we can take that zero value, which is how that shows up in the Newtonian mechanics, and substitute instead a fractal dimension number, which will be some kind of decimal fraction between 1 and 2, and then this will allow us to do things previously inconceivable, like predict the future and stuff like that. See, one thing I guess I should say, since we've sort of drifted into this fairly rappy place, is the idea that the universe is... the universe is growing toward itself. It's not moving outward from its origin. It's moving toward its completion. And this is called teleology. It's very unwelcome in most scientific modeling, but that's a legacy from the 19th century, where they were so concerned to get God out of the picture that they wanted everything to happen through one random process colliding with another random process and flipping out mule deer, elephants, and redwood trees. But in principle, we don't have to believe in God to believe in an attractor. At the end of the process, we see many kinds of attractors in the natural world. One way that I think of the psychedelic experience is, you know, you've heard me talk about hyperspace, superspace, this kind of thing. It really does seem to me that reality is some kind of a very complex geometric object of some sort. And you know how they teach you in trigonometry that all possible ellipses can be obtained by sectioning a cone? And that if you take the infinite set of ellipses and reconstruct them, you can reconstruct the cone. Well, the way I think of psychedelics and psychedelic tripping is you are sectioning a hyperdimensional object. And what you're coming back with is a lower dimensional map of this higher dimensional object. Well, everybody has a different map in the same way that there are an infinite number of elliptical sections of a cone, but they're all generated by the same object. And if it's a mystery to you how a simple finite object like a cone can generate an infinite number of elliptical sections, then it's going to be hard for you to understand how everybody can have a different psychedelic trip and yet be actually dealing with the same reality in hyperspace.